Hello, everyone. This is the New Rules Podcast, and I'm your host, Dimitri Symes Jr. For our very first episode of 2024, we want to give you a global economic outlook because this year is poised to be absolutely packed with momentous events, wars, elections, new alliances, new trading routes, basically everything you can imagine. To join me in offering predictions for 2024, I am very pleased to welcome SL Kantan, a geopolitical analyst and writer based in Bangalore, India. SL, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. It's my pleasure, Dimitri.
2023 was a very eventful year when it came to geopolitics and economics, but I have a feeling that 2024 will be even wilder. What are your geoeconomic expectations for 2024?
Okay. Yeah, 2024 will have a lot of watershed moments for sure. We still have two unresolved wars, one in Ukraine and one in the Middle East. And the Ukraine war, I think, is pretty much over. I think that Ukraine has lost, and in 2024, Russia will be able to consolidate its victories. And I think it's going to make a huge progress in Ukraine. And that war will be pretty much over in 2024. But as far as the Middle East war is concerned, it's very dangerous and risky. We don't know what sort of the groups and the nations are going to get involved. We could see the Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, and a whole bunch of other countries in the region could get involved. And it could be very dangerous for the whole world.
I want to ask you about the U.S. economy because, surprisingly enough, due to everything else that's going on in the world, this issue has gone under the radar. Biden himself insists that he's doing a great job, and it appears that Wall Street agrees with him. Just look at the stock market prices recently. Do you subscribe? Do you share this optimistic assessment of the U.S. economy? Or do you see some potential darker undercurrents here?
Yeah, it's a huge bubble. It's a massive bubble. And first of all, if you look at the stock market, it's only the top, the 10 companies in the U.S., the stock market, they account for something like 70-75% of the gains and the market cap. So it's a very distorted stock market, and it's pumped up by financial engineering, basically stock repurchase, stock buybacks. And if you look at the U.S., the government, they are borrowing like $3 trillion a year, and it's just not sustainable. It's just voodoo economics. And it's built on the house of cards. The reason that the dollar has been doing pretty well relatively to the rest of the other currencies in the world so far is because of the hike rates by the Fed. So they basically went from very close to 0% to 5%. So the U.S. Treasuries and the bonds, they have very high yields. So a lot of people are pulling their money away from the rest of the world, and they're buying the treasuries just for bigger returns. But the flip side of that is that the U.S. is spending so much money on the interest rates. So they're paying something like $1 trillion a year just on the minimum payments on the existing debt. And when you combine that with the de-dollarization efforts that are going on in the rest of the world, it's a very, very bad situation for the U.S.
Yeah, and I think it's important to emphasize this is not just government debt we're talking about. We're talking also about massive private debt. We're talking about massive credit card debt that ordinary Americans have. You know, I know that the issue of debt has been, you know, discussed for decades, if not longer. But it really does seem that this sort of economic system, which is based on spending beyond your means, I'm not sure how sustainable that is going into 2024, given all of the sort of turbulence that we're starting to see in the world right now.
Yeah. So the U.S. has been living in a fantasy world since the World War II. You know, the Bretton Woods Agreement that made the dollar, the king dollar, and the global reserve currency. And then they basically would defaulted on the obligations in 1971 when they went off the gold standard. And then it was basically backed up by petrodollar, right? The U.S. dollar became backed not by gold, but by Saudi oil. But that ride is now coming to an end. So if you look at the BRICS expansion, Saudi Arabia has now joined BRICS. And the future is going to be more and more countries are going to trade in their local currencies, and they are also trying to create a BRICS reference currency, or like a basket of currencies, or the currency that is backed up by the commodities. So the details have to be worked out, but the de-dollarization is very, very real. And you can see that in the news every day. And the effect is going to be seen in 1, 2, 3, 4 years. It's a gradual process. And if you look at the U.S. dollar's share in the global reserve currencies, it's now only 58%. Okay, so when that drops to, like, say, 48%, then it'll have a huge impact on the psychology of the world. And then when it drops to, say, 40%, then the value of the dollar will start to plummet.
I definitely want to return to the topic of de-dollarization a bit later in our conversation. But first, I just want to return to a closer look at the U.S. economy, because when I think of long-term sustainable economic development, I usually think of two things: industrial capacity and technological innovation. When it comes to these two factors, which country is better positioned for a stronger 2024, the United States or China?
I would say definitely China. You know, so there was the interview with the CEO of Raytheon. And he said something very shocking. He said, we depend on thousands of Chinese suppliers for the Raytheon products, right? So Raytheon is the military industrial complex giant. So what it shows is that nothing in the US can be done without the supply chain, raw materials, or the products from China. And they have totally de-industrialized themselves, the U.S., over the last 40 years. And they're going to pay a price. And they thought that they had this one leverage in the semiconductor chip industry. So they forced the Netherlands and Japan and South Korea and Taiwan to not to sell chips, or to not to make chips for China. But what we saw in 2023 was Huawei was able to make seven nanometer semiconductor chips for its 5G smartphone. So China is making breakthroughs. And they're now developing the architecture for five nanometers and even three nanometers. And once they reach five nanometer, then the U.S. basically has no advantage. And if you just follow the science news from China, they keep making breakthroughs every day in some sector or another. Yeah. So I would say we will see a lot of big news from China in 2024 in various sectors, in semiconductors, the artificial intelligence, the quantum computing, robots, 5.5G, the autonomous vehicles, drones, military weapons, and so on.
Yeah. And I just, you know, again, I want to back up what you say, because when you look at the statistics, for example, China is the leading producer and owner of industrial robots, which suggests that they're not only developing cutting edge technology, but they're the country that is most successful at putting these, to new technologies to economic use. No less significantly, I think, is that China is the current world leader when it comes to 5G and 6G telecommunication development. And this is, you know, game-changing stuff, because if railroads were the main economic artery of the 19th century, in the digital 21st century, telecommunication networks are playing that same role. So whoever has the most developed telecommunication networks has the greatest ability to scale up in the digital economy.
Yes. You know, I went on Twitter and I asked people, hey, what is the 5G speed, the download speed in your city, in your country where you live? And the responses I got from the U.S., were so shocking, were so low. And the people in China were posting their download speeds, which is like 500 megabits, 700 megabits, I mean, sorry, gigabits. Oh, no, no, sorry, megabits. So they were posting photos with 500 megabits, 700 megabits, and so on. And then from the U.S., people were saying 50 megabits, 100 megabits. So there's a huge difference. And the Chinese, the government, they're focused on the overall, the development, right? So they're not so focused on the profits. So they want to enable very cheap the infrastructure, like 5G, 5.5G is their goal for 2024. And then they let the rest of the industries thrive on this solid the infrastructure. And they're focusing on what is known as the fourth industrial revolution. And it's a the combination of 5G, 5.5G, robots, the artificial intelligence, and what is known as the Internet of Things.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that in addition to these sort of high-tech developments, we also see China make gains in traditional, more traditional industries like automobiles. Since 2020, China has significantly increased its share of the global automobile market. And we see a particularly big jump since 2022. Now, why is that? Our audience members may ask. Well, the Ukraine conflict is actually the answer to that question, because in 2022, all the big Western Japanese brands left the Russian market. So you now have a market of 150 million people with money to spend, with demand for cars, and their traditional suppliers are gone. So who moves in to take advantage of the situation? Obviously, the Chinese automobile companies. And I can tell our audience members that if you try to order a taxi in Moscow right now, there's a pretty good chance that you will be picked up by a Chinese car like Haval, Geely, Chery, so on and so forth. So this is, you know, yet another interesting example where geopolitics and economics come together in the most unpredictable way.
Yes. And also, China has made progress, leaps and bounds in the electric cars, which somehow Europe totally missed out on. So in 2023, with two out of the three, the electric cars in the world were made and sold in China. And they have really mastered the entire supply chain for the electric cars. So they make the batteries. So like something like 90% of the electric car batteries in the world are now made in China. And the battery is one of the most the expensive parts of the electric car. And even, you know, Ford, they had to make a deal with a Chinese company, CATL, to get the battery technology. And that has been a huge factor in China becoming the number one the exporter of cars in 2023. So just in the last 4 years, China surpassed the U.S., South Korea, Germany, and Japan to become the world's number one exporter of cars. And BYD, the Chinese company, became the world's number one pure battery electric vehicle maker, surpassing with Tesla in the last quarter of 2023.
Essel, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. I want to read for you a recent headline from CNN. China's economy had a miserable year in 2023. 2024 might be even worse. Now, this headline is pretty representative of how Western mainstream media talks about the Chinese economy. They tend to emphasize things like economic slowdown, aging population, real estate crisis, overregulation, leaving foreign investment. Does Western media have a point when they talk about the Chinese economy in this way? Is there, you know, this sort of grounds for serious pessimism?
Sure. You know, China does face those problems that CNN mentions, in terms of the demographics and the real estate the crisis. Those are the two big problems. But the first point about China's economy doing bad in 2023, that's a joke, okay? So China's economy grew 5.5% in 2023. And it accounted for one third of the global growth in 2023. So China's contribution to the global GDP growth was number one in 2023. So but how can you say that the number one country was doing bad? But as for the demographics, you know, it's a problem. But it's not going to be a huge problem right away. It's a very gradual problem. So the workforce is going to decrease by about 1 million people per year over the next decade. But that's why China has all these robots and the automation. And they're also proactively moving the low-end manufacturing to rest of the world, like Vietnam, Mexico, and even to my country, India. So there are lots of solutions for the demographic decline. And the real estate problem, they have a lot of solutions and a lot of flexibility. So they'll be able to control the decline. And it's also good because the prices of the homes in big cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen are just super high. So if the prices come down by, say, 10% or so, that'll actually be very good for the young people in China.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, this returns us back to the fundamental question. Which economy is more fundamentally sound, the U.S. economy or the Chinese economy?
Well, I would say there's no doubt that it's a Chinese economy because they are able to master the entire supply chain, right? So they can make shoes and they can make semiconductors. They can make the toys, they can make the electric cars. And they work as a society. So if you look at the government, the corporations, the people, they all work together. The local government, the central government, small corporations, big corporations. So they all sit together and they plan for the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And they don't have slogans like the U.S., right? So like if you watch the U.S. Politicians or even the think tanks, they all have very simple solutions, right? Whatever the problem, the answer is always just one phrase or one sentence. Make America great again, small government, but tax cuts. And then you look at the Chinese five-year plans, they will have 75 action items, right? So they will say, these are the 75 things we will do over the next 5 years to make China great. So that's the sort of the comprehensive planning and the development that will make sure that China keeps succeeding.
I want to play devil's advocate again, because it seems that in some ways the Biden administration acknowledges the fact that it's starting to lose the economic race to China. That's why they instituted the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and they claim to have invested over $100 billion in creating new technologies, new factories, new jobs, trying to reindustrialize America. Is it possible that the U.S. over the next several years could get its act together? Is this a genuine attempt to fix America's problems, or is this yet another Biden Potemkin village?
Yeah, you know, the problem with the U.S. is they have lost the manufacturing skills over the last 40 years. So, and that skill is not going to come back. Right. So if you want to start a manufacturing plant, you need people with lots of experience. And that experience is gone. So the workers are gone. The managers are gone. The technology is not there. So they can never bring back manufacturing. And what Biden has been trying to do is to steal the technology from Taiwan's TSMC. So it's basically a forced technology theft. And they brought in these TSMC scientists and the engineers to the U.S. And they said, let's start a 5-nanometer semiconductor chip lab. But it's falling behind in a schedule, and it's costing a lot more, but twice as much. So that process has been a of disaster. You know, in China, the government, they give subsidies to the corporations, but they place very strict rules. So they would say, okay, so we're going to give you $5 billion and you have to make it happen by this time. Right? In the U.S., there's no accountability. So Biden gives $150 billion to the corporations. And the first thing that the corporations do is to use some of that money for stock buybacks. So it's a big scam, and they're not going to be able to make any significant progress.
Yeah, we've been talking about U.S.-China competition, but I think it's important to emphasize for our audience members that this is bigger than just U.S.-China competition, because in 2023, we saw a burgeoning economic showdown between U.S. and BRICS Plus. During the BRICS summit last August in South Africa, we saw the alliance add 6 new members, the biggest expansion in the organization's history. And Russia has promised that in 2024, we'll see another round of expansion under its BRICS chairmanship. So, SL, what do you expect from BRICS in 2024?
Yeah, I think it's going to be tectonic changes, because about 40 countries have shown the desire to join the new BRICS. So in 2023, 6 new countries joined, and they're going to officially become the members sometime in January 2024. And now Russia is leading the BRICS Plus presidency in 2024. So they're going to allow a lot of new strategic members to join BRICS. And it's, you know, this is the biggest, the pillar of the multipolar world. So people are talking about the emerging multipolar world, and BRICS is going to be the foundation of that. And the BRICS community is going to focus on cooperation, trade, development, using the local currencies, and to move away from the dollars, and to move away from sanctions and wars. And so this is the biggest the change. And I think when we look back at the history of the 21st century, BRICS will be the pivotal the organization that defined the 21st century.
I want to give our audience member just some statistics. Following the BRICS expansion that's going into effect, that went into effect January 1st, you're going to see BRICS occupy 36% of global GDP, which is greater than that of the G7. But no less significantly, you see BRICS occupy a leading position when it comes to energy markets, because now BRICS controls 39% of global oil exports, 45.9% of proven reserves, and, you know, up to 50% or more of natural gas reserves. And some of the members that are potentially discussed for next year are Algeria and Venezuela. So you could see BRICS potentially in 2024 consolidate its position as an energy powerhouse.
Yes. So, you know, if you just add Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, they make a significant share of natural gas and oil and even lithium. And then you add China's manufacturing and the rise of the middle class from India and China, I mean, it's just a very comprehensive, right? You know, so you have the manufacturing, you have the natural resources, you have the technology, the middle class. It's just the best combination of the countries. And best of all, you know, they treat each other as partners, right? With the U.S., there's no such thing as partnership. You know, there is just one boss, the U.S., and then they can do whatever they want to all the vassals. They can blow up the Nord Stream pipeline, and Germany has to pretend as if nothing happened. So with BRICS, that's not the case. It's a very new paradigm, you know, where the countries work together as partners, and they focus on, win-win partnership. And I think that's the beauty that is going to be very sustainable, because whatever the members do, they do it because it's in their interest.
In 2023, there was a lot of conversation about the potential creation of a unified BRICS currency. That ultimately did not end up happening. But do you think this is something that could happen in 2024? And what are the necessary preconditions for the creation of a unified BRICS currency?
Yeah, you know, that's the trillion-dollar question. And there are two ways to do that, the BRICS currency. One is to create a basket of the currencies, just like the IMF has the SDR. So they can do something like that, a basket of the currencies. The second option is to create a basket of the commodities. So, you know, so you have some the X amount of BRICS, the currency is going to be backed by the oil, natural gas, lithium, wheat, rice, whatever you can think of. So, there could be gold as well, right? And that, in my opinion, would be the best form of the currency, because it's just not fiat currency that the Federal Reserve Bank and others can just print out of thin air. And we have to see how it develops. It's a very complex thing, and especially when you have so many members, it takes time to build the consensus. So we will see, like, if it happens in 2024 or 2025.
But I do think it's interesting that given all of the conversation about the demand for a BRICS currency, the United States is doing absolutely nothing to reassure people about the stability, the trustworthiness of the U.S. dollar. In fact, they're doing the opposite. The United States is currently in talks with its European allies about potentially taking those Russian financial assets that they seized at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict and transferring it to Ukraine. Now, if this were to happen, this would be the financial equivalent of a nuclear attack, because it would show that the United States is prepared, over for geopolitical reasons, to not just freeze your assets, but to literally steal them and give them to your worst enemies. What would countries like Saudi Arabia, like China, Iran, well, not Iran, because they've already been screwed over, but, you know, anyone in the global south, India, you know, what would be the conclusions that they would draw from such a bold experiment?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is the stupidest theft in the history of mankind, because the $300 billion is not going to ruin Russia. They will survive, and it's not going to make the U.S. Rich, right? The U.S. Borrows about $300 billion in just 1 month. So, but the damage it causes to the trustworthiness and the credibility and the whole the sanctity of the financial structure is gone. And no country is going to trust the U.S. again. And the problem with the U.S. is the elites, the pundits, the media, the politicians, they live in a bubble. They are not able to see the end of Pax Americana. They're not able to see the end of the American century, right? And that's gone. The American century is practically over. But that concept is not sinking into the American psychology. And it's a huge problem. So they keep doing what they've been doing, like as if it's 1993, when they had the unipolar moment, Russia was weak, China was weak, and there was nobody to challenge the hegemon. But those days are gone. And it's really, you know, sad because it's going to bring in a lot of, you know, a shock to the American society. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of a the civil war in the U.S. in the next decade.
So in addition to finance, I think that another potentially interesting avenue for cooperation by BRICS is logistics. Because historically, the collective West has had a near monopoly on commercial shipping, but we're seeing that slowly change due to sanctions, other geopolitical reasons. And the Houthis now declared that the Red Sea is basically off limits for Western cargo ships. Does all of this indicate that logistics and shipping is potentially ripe for the picking when it comes to BRICS?
Yeah, you know, because like there was this sort of propaganda by people like Peter Zeihan, who said, yeah, you know, we the U.S., we protect the sea lanes of the world. But now you see that the mighty U.S. is not able to do anything about the Houthis in Yemen. And that's a small group is able to scare off all of the European and the American ships. But they can say, you know, we're not going to attack the BRICS ships, right? So, and the whole the supply chain, you know, if you look at the top 10 busiest seaports, the container seaports in the world, seven of them are in China. And one or two more are in South Korea and in Singapore. So the trade is all happening on the east side of the world. And the Western ports, if you look at Los Angeles and so on, they've really dropped in trade, and they're not significant anymore. So in whatever way you slice the cake, the U.S. is losing its preeminence, and the power has moved to the east. And you see a very symbiotic relationship in the east, right? Russia, China, it's like a perfect marriage made in heaven. So one has the resources, the military, the diplomatic skills, and China has the manufacturing and all of that. It's like a perfect combination. And the Asian countries, most of them are being very smart. They're not taking the sides between China and the U.S. They're playing the neutral. And that's the way to go forward, is for each country to focus on its own, the economic interests, geopolitical interests, and stay out of, wars and conflicts.
Yeah. And I think in addition to Russia and China, it's really important to mention another emerging key player in the new logistical model of the world, and that is Iran. And we know that for 40 years, the United States has sought to isolate, marginalize Iran. But we're seeing that as part of Russia's pivot to Asia and China's Belt and Road Initiative, Iran is once again becoming essential to global trade. Because if you, for example, look at the international north-south transport corridor, which Russia and India are building to help provide themselves with an alternative to the Suez Canal Road, that goes straight for Iran. And when you look at Chinese Belt and Road projects aimed at, you know, establishing new ports, new gateways to the Middle East, Iranian ports also play a central role in that. So I think that in 2024, you're going to see Iran further break out of Western sanctions, isolation, and blockade. And you're going to see Iran blossom as a new logistical hub in a multipolar world.
Absolutely, absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah.
You know, and with them joining BRICS, and the smartest thing that Iran did was to make peace with Saudi Arabia. Right, because that was the U.S. Strategy of the divide and rule in the Middle East. So now that Saudi Arabia and Iran have made peace, it gives the Iranians a huge opportunity to focus on the infrastructure projects, the trade projects that you mentioned. So yes, this year will be the coming out party for the Iranians.
BRICS no doubt has a lot of potential, and we've already discussed the financial potential, the trade potential, the logistical potential. But it's obvious that the organization also faces a lot of challenges. And perhaps the biggest is the internal contradiction between some of the players, most notably between India and China. When, as we look, you know, at 2024 and what lies ahead, do you see any chance that these two Asian giants can somehow reconcile their differences and form a united front when it comes to BRICS expansion and other issues?
Yeah. So, you know, my guess, okay, so in 2024, we are going to have the elections in India. And it looks pretty obvious that Modi is going to win again, and he will be the Prime Minister of India for another 5 years. And I believe that this will give Modi the chance to make peace with China, because he cannot do it before the elections. Because it's politics, right? If he makes peace with China now, it will be seen as being weak, and he'll be attacked by the opposition. So just like Richard Nixon, the U.S. president, was able to seek rapprochement with China in 1972, I think that Modi will be able to make a big gesture to China once the 2024 elections are over. Because India knows, the rise of the multipolar world, the decline of the U.S. power. And if you look at India's dependency on China for pharmaceuticals, electronics, machinery, and all of that, we know that China is the place to be friends with, and we won't be able to decouple from China in a long time. And just the pragmatism, the geopolitical pragmatism, it gives us the imperative that we have to have good relations with China. So I think that as the U.S. power declines, naturally, India will have a better and better relations with China.
And it seems that one of the people who could actually help force Modi's hand in that direction is none other than Joe Biden. Because I think a story that probably most of our audience members have missed last year is sort of the growing tensions between Biden on the one hand and Modi on the other. And the biggest, sign of that is the scandal over the U.S. and Canadian decision to provide safe haven to Khalistani separatists who want to establish a separate Punjabi Sikh state, carve it out of India. And so this is not an isolated incident, because we also see the United States support color revolution attempts in Bangladesh. We see them, strengthen their involvement in Nepal. We saw how they overthrew the government of Imran Khan in Pakistan because that government didn't want to see us stop its relations with Russia. So, I can imagine that if I'm Modi and I'm looking at the geopolitical map, I'm reminded of Henry Kissinger's famous quote, "Being America's enemy is dangerous, but to be America's friend is truly fatal."
Yeah. And, the U.S. Definitely has a lot of the influence in the Indian media and think tanks and so on. But they just cannot help themselves play the divide and rule and to punish the allies to show who is in charge. And it's just in their the DNA. And if you look at the way that Russia deals with India, and even during the Cold War, Russia was very non-interventionist. So Russia, the Soviet Union, had a lot more power than India, but they always respected India's sovereignty. And the same thing, you can see it happening with Putin's Russia, right? So Putin doesn't give lectures to India. He doesn't demand what India's foreign policy should be, where we should buy the weapons from. So that sort of the partnership based on the equality. So it's very natural that India is going to lean more towards Russia. And I think that Russia might be able to play a big role in fixing the relations between India and China, because both India and China, both Modi and Xi Jinping, have very, very good relations with Putin. So who is better than Putin to bring those two countries, those two leaders together?
I want to remind our audience members that you watched and listened to the New Rules podcast. I'm your host, Dimitri Symes Jr., and our guest today was SL Kantan. SL, where can our audience members go to keep up with your work?
Okay, so I'm on with Twitter. I have Substack. And I'm also going to start a new podcast called Geopolitics Demystified. And it's going to start in a few weeks. So look out for that on Spotify and so on. And we are trying to educate the people on the new world that is coming up. And we're going to present the perspectives that you won't find in the mainstream media.
And if you want to keep up with our work, the very first thing you should do is like this video, subscribe to us on Rumble and on Twitter, and make sure to send this video far and wide because it really helps get our message out there. Thank you all for tuning in. Happy New Year. Till next time.